Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Welcome to On Driven on Joy 94.9 with your host Kafam and Hugh. On tonight's show we have Susie from People Living with HIV Victoria. Susie will talk about her organisation and HIV in Australia and around the world. She will also give us, or tell us, a little bit about herself. You know, it's an Indian lady from London coming to Australia and becoming involved with the HIV organisation in Victoria. If you have any questions for Susie during the show, don't hesitate to call Nick on reception on 9699 2949, or email us or SMS. Welcome to Joy 94.9. This is On Driven with a very end of his song.
What a lovely finale.
This is Joy 94.9, On Driven multicultural show. And tonight you're with Kafam and you. And our wonderful guest, Susie Malhotra. Susie, welcome.
How do you say now? Is it Malhotra or Malhotra?
Well, certainly not Malhotra. It's Malhotra, or we can say Malhotra.
And Susie's from People Living with HIV AIDS Victoria. Welcome, Susie, to On Driven.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good. Tell us a little bit about your position in this, you know, organisation.
Oh, weren't you going to ask me about my fantastic song that I opened the show with?
Oh, my goodness. She's taking over the show. Yes, Susie, please tell us what you know, why you chose that track.
Before Susie does that, Susie's picked all the music for tonight's show.
That's right. So stay tuned for a lot of exciting taste in music.
It doesn't get much better than that. No, I'm going through a daggy vintage phase, and I'm fed up with people saying, oh, this, there's nothing new anymore, and I absolutely believe them, so nothing like ELO. And I thought it was going to be a sunny day today, and it's not, so no blue skies, I'm afraid.
No, it's absolutely pouring down outside. I can see it through the window here, but it's good music. I love that music.
Absolutely.
I like ELO. So, Susie, tell us a little bit about your organisation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, our organisation is called People Living with HIV AIDS Victoria. Acronyms are always the fashion, so we're actually PLWHA Victoria. It makes it that little bit easier. Mm. We're a support, advocacy, information and education group for people living with HIV AIDS in Victoria. And it's not just about people who are positive, it's about people who are associated with them, so whether they're friends, lovers, carers, family, and anybody really who has sort of, you know, questions or issues about HIV.
So what, if you just ask me, the people who are carers or friends or a partner with someone with HIV, what do you do for them?
Well, we run a whole load of programs and groups. Obviously, our first focus is positive people. We run a group for people who are newly diagnosed. That's called Genesis. Oh, sorry. It used to be called Genesis. It's called Phoenix. Somebody's going to be kicking me in the office tomorrow. We run education and health information for positive people. So, you know, while many people are living with HIV, they're also dealing with, you know, complications of side effects, the emotional stuff, you know, relationships aren't always necessarily healthy sometimes for people who find out they're, diagnosed. So we run, you know, we give a lot of information around health. We also run, quite interestingly, a phone line, Connect, which is for anyone with questions about HIV or, you know, think they've had some kind of incident that sort of would put them at risk. And that, interestingly enough, is actually for everyone out there. So,
all right. So what's the number?
1-800-035-128.
Or you can find out more information on the website, wouldn't you?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I'm just going to go and do a bit of research and come back with that number.
Just save your ass there.
So, Susie, tell us your position in the organisation. What do you do?
Okay, I'm the Senior Health Promotion Officer. I think that basically just means I was given the senior bit because I'd been there for so long, they felt they had to reward me in some way. We're a really small organisation. We only have 7.5 staff, which is still pretty amazing considering we started off from three staff, you know, barely 10 years ago. I manage the health promotion side of the organisation, so it's ensuring that we reach our client group, that we run timely and effective programs around HIV. So whatever current issues are in HIV, if we're noticing that, you know, there's a new, for example, people giving up smoking, you know, we know that smoking is one of the cofactors that can degenerate, quality of life for people with HIV. Mm. So, you know, we try and respond appropriately to whatever the needs of positive people are. Mm. And, you know, whether it's dealing with side effects, traveling with your HIV when you're going overseas, you know, your HIV medication when you're going overseas, those are really big issues. Mm. You know, sort of limitations for people with HIV to go to foreign countries. As I said before, we run a support group for people who are newly diagnosed. So we look at the medical aspects of what it means to be positive, the emotional stuff, and, you know, what people do for social support and disclosing their status if they choose to do so.
Who funds your organisation?
We're mostly funded by the Department of Human Services, the BBV, which is Bloodborne Viruses and Sexually Transmitted Infections Department. We do get donations to the organisation, and we'd like to be independently sort of, you know, to fundraise a lot more, but unfortunately, you know, it takes a lot of manpower and resources.
Mm. Do you get a lot of volunteers in to help out with the organisation?
Yeah, we do. I mean, unlike somebody, say, like the Victorian AIDS Council that has a strategic program for recruiting, training and, you know, maintaining volunteers, we use them a bit more on an ad hoc basis, you know, so people see us around major carnival time, like midsummer, you know, we always have volunteers to help at stall and other festivals. You know, lots of the party organisers are great and give us the proceeds of cloakrooms, so we're always roping people in to come and do some shifts there. And I think some presenters of this program in the past have very... generously volunteered their time, and you know, and whether it's, you know, sending out our newsletter, people coming and stuffing envelopes, we keep it really informal, but we always welcome people who've got a bit of time to come.
Mm. It sounds interesting. And you say you've got 7 people working in your organisation. Do you know what the breakdown is? What do people or everyone do?
I mean, God, if I didn't know what people did, I don't think I'd deserve that senior in my role, would I? We have an executive officer, Sunny Williams, who manages the organisation. Above that, we actually have a board of management, and they're a bunch of HIV-positive people who contribute to... The strategic direction of the organisation.
Right.
They're not responsible operationally for the organisation. Mm. That's down to our executive officer. And then we have a health promotion team, which is myself and somebody called Vic Perry. We have a campaigns coordinator, Daniel Readers, who we were very lucky to just get funding for just over a year ago. So we've, you know, it's a fantastic part of the organisation that we can expand the work on. We have an administrator, somebody who runs a phone line, John Colvin, and... I'm just trying to think.
And are they listening to right tonight?
Oh, God, please don't, because you're going to give me a bad time the next time I see you. And but also, most importantly, we have a project called the Speakers Bureau, which is a bunch of HIV-positive people who are trained to provide information, and just basic information to the wide community out there who might want to know what it's like to be a positive person living with HIV. And Max Niggle is the coordinator of the Speakers Bureau.
So they go to schools, perhaps?
Absolutely. Schools, colleges, you know, hospitals, private companies.
This is Orange Ribbon. You're listening to Kafam and Hugh. And our guest tonight is Susie from People Living with HIV AIDS Victoria.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
Our Instagram Joy 94.9, called Multicultural Show with Hugh and Kafam, and our guest tonight, Susie Malhotra. And you chose that song. Why did you choose that song?
Oh, it's one of my favourites. It's a Hindi song called Aaj Ki Raat, which basically translates as Tonight's the Night. Tonight's the night, it's going to happen.
And it's a classic, isn't it?
It is. It's from a film that came from a film called Don, and Don itself was a remake of a film by the same name about 25 years ago, really successful. And it's really evocative of when I was in Delhi 2 years ago for the big wedding and sort of party season, and I was there with my boyfriend and another friend, and wherever we went, every wedding and every party we went, it was always being played, and it was just brilliant because you just go nuts on the dance floor.
And who were the main cast there for that movie, Don?
Who were the main
cast?
Oh, Shah Rukh Khan, of course.
Oh, that's a remake. What about the original?
Amitabh Bachchan.
And Hema Malini?
I think, I can't remember. Or was it... Oh, I don't know. I think it might have been Parveen Barbie, actually.
Talk about putting Susie on the spot.
No. I think it was Parveen Barbie or somebody like that.
Yeah, but a very big name in Indian cinema and a classic.
Absolutely.
And a little bit about your background. Where were you born?
I was born in England, in a tiny little village called London.
The gay village.
Yeah, oh God, please don't say that. No, I was born in London, born and brought up there. My parents were first generation Indians there, and they came over about 50 years ago to the UK from India. And they had a one-year-old, my little sister, well, my elder sister in tow, and I was born a couple of years later.
Okay, so she was born in India.
She was born there, and right. She came over when she was a year old.
So why did your parents move to London?
Look, I think it's why most migrants move, you know, overseas for a better life, a better quality of life. It was interesting because at the time they came over in the 60s, there was already a massive recruitment drive going on from India, sort of for people to, work in the transport industry. Mm. My parents actually came over as professionals. My father was a... used to work for the airlines, and then he actually was a journalist, used to work for Reuters.
Okay.
So, yeah, my parents just, you know, wanted to try something different, wanted the kids to have a good life and a new life, and, you know, you can't knock that, really.
Mm. And did your parents have an arranged marriage?
No, they didn't.
Oh, scandalous. Yeah,
absolutely. My father, for a while, was teaching secretarial school, and my mum was one of his students, so I always wind her up and say, well, were you taking a memo, Miss Malhotra? She said, I wasn't Malhotra at the time. But no, they just met, and different sort of, not different castes, but different sort of Indian groups. My dad was Hindu Punjabi, my mum was Sindhi, and I think there was a bit of angst in the family, but they did it, and they
just
got
like
married.
Bollywood.
Absolutely.
So you said different groups. What does it actually mean?
You know, different regional groups of India. You know, people have different religions, they speak different languages, different caste systems, different classes. I suppose I can't really compare it. You know, Hindu Punjabi, which is one of the major sort of, you know, ethnic groups there, and mums from down south. Originally, Punjabis and Sindhis both came from Pakistan before partition.
Right.
But, you know, everybody went off in their separate directions.
Was it easier for your parents then to move to London to get away from India? And
I think it was hard. I think everyone was making that mass exodus out of India, you know, and it was fantastic. It was a great life, and everyone was really quite envious. You know, if you were saying you were going to go live abroad, or Vilat, as we call it.
It is still pretty much the same at the moment here, isn't it? Because if you are an international student from India, your marriage suitability has gone off the roof.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm sure I would have got into a lot of trouble for saying that. Look, you know, you're a commodity if you've got foreign education. You know, you've seen the world, you're travelled. You go back to India and say, hey, I've got a foreign visa or whatever.
But Susie, your parents... when you were 6 and your sister was 7, yes. Sent you back to India, didn't they?
Yeah, sent me back to where I came from. No, sent my sister back to where
she
came from.
Yeah, that's right.
A thing about Indians, and, you know, certainly my family, is that above anything else, they value education. You know, it's what sets you up in life. It, you know, gives you a good career, gives you a good standing in society, you know, and gives you lots of money, of course. So the education system in India had always been very good at that time, and my parents made a very hard decision, and a very hard financial decision, to send me and my sister over to India to study in a Catholic convent boarding school.
Oh, my God.
In the mountains. It's not Sound of Music, but it was close.
Why? Because when I was in boarding school in India, we were paying about $100 per half a year at the time. So was your boarding school a lot more expensive?
No, I don't know. I just know that it was... I know my parents were financially stretched, and, you know, I'm forever grateful to them, and, you know... I have these awful regrets where I don't want to think of them having suffered financially while they were putting my sister and I through school and paying for uniforms and bloomers and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it was, you know, it wasn't just the school fees, it was the flights, absolutely. Mm. So, you know, it was really hard for 5 years while we were there. We could barely afford to come home sort of very often.
But Susie, 6 years old. Sent to a country you'd never been to.
That's quite callous.
Because
I was put into boarding school really young, and my experience has been, you know, that's quite callous to put me so young in boarding school. Did you ever feel that way at the time?
Oh, I certainly didn't have that consciousness at the time to go, I'm
so callous.
No, I don't. I can look back now and reflect on it and say, you know, oh, I don't know if I'd do that with my kids.
Mm.
But my parents' reasoning for doing it was faultless. You know, they didn't, you know, they meant the best. It was weird. You know, it's quite surreal. I had been to India a few times, but when I was over there and boarding school, I remember thinking I hated this. And my poor sister, I came a day after my sister started, and nobody spoke to my sister for the first 24 hours because when she was younger, she looked slightly sort of Asian. So everybody thought that she was Chinese and couldn't speak English, so they didn't talk to her. And I'm thinking, God, that's a fair sign of cruelty at boarding schools. Mm. But the rest of it, look, it was great. You know, I can't regret not having gone because it's where I learned to speak Hindi. You know, while the syllabus was in English, I had extra tuition in Hindi. Great discipline. didn't develop an obsession with boys much afterwards. but look,
how did your sister cope?
I think she found it a bit harder because she was older, and I think she was at the age where kids start bullying and start teasing, and I think they do, you know, I hate the stereotypes, but I think girls can be quite cruel when they're older and going through puberty.
Now, you have a younger brother, don't you?
I do.
Was he sent to India as well?
No, spoilt brat. He was allowed to stay at home, and it was quite funny because every time my sister and I did come home, he was so used to being the only child. He'd go, well, my mummy bought me this, and my daddy would go, excuse me, there are our parents as well. So it was a strange. I think it created an odd situation for the first few years after we came back, but, you know, nothing really now.
When you came back for holidays, obviously you spent most of your time away from your parents. What was it like coming home to them?
Oh, it was like Mater and Pater. No, it wasn't. I don't remember very much. I think it was a bit distant. But, you know, you're back sort of, you know, after we came back, I think my parents were brilliant. They decided that we were really unhappy by the end and they brought us back. And then when I sort of developed the consciousness that came afterwards, I went, why didn't you let me stay there? I loved it. And they went, no, you didn't. You hated it.
Mm. I'm just only bringing back to the point where your brother wasn't sent to boarding school. Has the fact that he's a son anything to do with it?
Well, he got his own way like all boys do, Indian boys do. No, I mean, he always had, it was always in the game plan to send it off. I think he just spat the dummy. And because he was the first son as well, I think my parents felt very protective over him. He was a bit of a sickly child, and thank God my brother lives in London and can't hear any of this. I think, you know, my parents were afraid to let him go because they just thought he was a bit weak.
And how is his Hindi?
He can't speak Hindi. Useless. And if anyone needed the discipline in the family, it was him.
Republicans say could die, you know. However, it's your dog.
You know, you've actually pronounced it the way you say his shirt. It's kutta and kurta. Kutta's a dog and kurta's a shirt.
I'm making fun of my Hindi.
Did you find it difficult getting back to London and settling in there?
No. I think it was quite weird having boys in the school. You know, it's like, oh my God, who are those things there? Because it was a girls' school. I was so square and boring and quiet at school.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it took me a really long time to come out of my shell. I was a sort of bit of a nerdy student, wore big octagonal glasses and duffel coats and, yeah, just not brilliant.
And when you went back, did you go back with an Indian accent?
I don't think so.
So there was no people looking at you strangely when you went back to school?
I think they looked at me strangely because I actually spoke better than half of them did.
grammatically.
Yeah. No, I didn't. I mean, let's not forget, boarding schools at the time in India were very much about diplomats' children.
What's that?
Like, you know, like the sort of diplomats, you know, diplomats who were working over there. They were sending their kids off to decent schools and stuff. So actually at school, while they were all Indian, they were, you know, we had a lot of Thai students there. We had a lot of French students there and, you know, lots of people from, say, Vietnam and other places in Europe. So probably, it was very cosmopolitan.
Probably everyone spoke the Queen's English.
Well, if they couldn't speak it, they certainly could write it.
This is Orange Ribbon with Kafam and Hugh.
This is a podcast from Joy 94.9, a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station. For more content, please go to our website at joy.org.au, or if you're in Melbourne, tune in to Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Orange Ribbon with Kafam and Hugh, Joy 94.9's multicultural show. And tonight's guest is Susie. If you have any questions for Susie, you can call Nick on 96992949. Susie's from the organisation People Living with HIV AIDS Victoria. So call Nick, and if you've got any questions, we'll put them to Susie.
Or you can SMS 0427 Joy 949. Now, Susie, a little bit about your background. you know, with, let me just find a bio sheet, about coming to Australia. What brought you here?
Oh, God, I suddenly have to think. No, I was just still singing to myself, so...
Oh, yeah, the song, that's right. So you're looking at me because I haven't said why you chose that song. I'm all over the place today. So, Susie, please go ahead.
Oh, nothing exciting. I'm a rock chick at heart, and Depeche Mode are one of my favourite bands of all time. I spent my 40th birthday screaming with 25,000 people in Hyde Park the day they played. So it's got a lot of fantastic memories.
Excellent.
You know what? Because English is not my first language, I always say Depeche Mode, and then everyone started laughing at me at work in Australia. But anyway,
that's because you're Chinese.
The pitchy mode.
we've got a message here. I just want to read it. It says, "Hey guys, good luck with the show. Welcome back, Hugh, Mark. Cheers, Mark."
Okay, again, Kafam is not mentioned.
No,
I'm not too happy about it. Anyway, what's the next message?
Nobody likes you, Kafam. Anyway, let's get back to the show. And our guest tonight is Susie from People Living with HIV/AIDS Victoria. Susie, what brought you to Australia?
Times two.
Yes.
Well, I've been in Australia for about, oh God, coming up to nearly 12 years. I moved over ostensibly just for a year. I was married at the time, and I came over with my husband, whose family had already settled over here. So we thought, oh, why not come over for a year, see what it's like? And ended up liking it so much, I stayed. And I was never meant to come to Melbourne. I was actually supposed to be in Sydney. And at the 11th hour, plans changed. We came to Melbourne, and I thought, right, definitely not leaving here.
So how did you get involved with HIV/AIDS in Victoria?
I was actually working in HIV in the UK for about 5 years previously, until I came over. And it was certainly not a profession I had any grand plans or strategies to get into. I was the excellent Indian girl who did a graduate degree and then went and did her MBA and was either going to be doctor, lawyer, or businessman. And
that's so typical, isn't it? Because you ask a lot of people what they do amongst the Indians, they say, I'm doing MBA, MBA.
And which is great, you know, my mother loved it, but then I got the double dilemma where I did my graduate my graduate degree, and everyone went, oh, that's so nice, Mrs. Malhotra, your daughter's going to be such a great commodity in the marriage market. And then when I got a postgraduate, it was like, oh, no, she's too educated now. Nobody likes a wife who's smarter than her husband. So, I did that because I kind of felt I had to. But in the meantime, I was always doing voluntary work. I used to work with autistic children. It was always stuff I did while I was at school. I was actually cut out for a job in the BBC, but just... didn't do it. Oh, it's full of too many bitchy women. I couldn't do it. I saw a job that came up once just as a sort of administrator in a quite a unique organisation in the UK. It was called the Black HIV and AIDS Network. And it actually dealt with positive people, people with HIV who came from the African, Caribbean or Indian communities. And it actually kind of entailed having some cultural awareness of, you know, what it was like to be affected and coming from those communities. And they needed somebody with an Asian language or an Indian language, which I could speak. And then gradually over a period of about 3 or 4 years, just worked myself up in that organization, become a community care coordinator, which was actually providing direct support and counseling.
And I'm just curious, you know, because when someone ever tells me a breaking news, you're very difficult to, like when my sister had lost her child, I didn't know what to say. You know, when I called on the phone. So what's the best thing to say when a friend confides in you or to do?
Oh, look, it's really hard. You know, you can ask me that as a friend and ask me that as a professional.
Well, as a friend?
You kind of got to let people be. You know, you don't, while there's a certain, you talk about being empathetic, you know, you can't ever imagine what it's like for that person. We can all have gone through the same things, but everybody processes that information differently. The environments in which we, you know, experience losses or sadness are so different for all of us. You know, I could have some bad news, but I have a fantastically supportive family network and a partner and good friends. Some people dealing with that news have nothing, and it's really hard to sort of to find the strength to actually kind of, you know, move on from there. So I think when somebody does present themselves, you know, which is what I think you're sort of going with, you know, sending around a new HIV diagnosis, you have to work out what's the best approach for them by sort of taking the time to get to know what environment that is, you know, actually happened to them in.
With the HIV in Victoria. Now, you actually deal with HIV in Australia, don't you?
No, we're actually a Victorian organisation. We deal with positive people in Victoria. We have a membership of about 900 people, and these are positive people.
Okay.
We do work very closely with organisations interstate. You know, we work on campaigns and policies together. We do a lot of joint work. And, you know, we're looking at figures of, you know, sort of, it's about 17,000 people living with HIV in Australia at the moment, you know, 1,000 of which are new diagnoses. And this is in 2007. So, you know, it really helps to actually kind of share the information and the experiences that other organisations like ourselves are going through.
What impact does the influx of international students to Australia have on the HIV?
That's a really interesting point. It's actually quite a dynamic change that's happening. It's certainly in Victoria, you know, we're seeing thousands of students coming in to Victoria, obviously for the opportunity of education. And traditionally, the picture that we've seen of HIV infection in Australia has been white, gay, you know, middle-class men. And I think we're beginning to, and we can certainly document people's sexual behaviours as well, you know, just see what people sort of, you know, like doing or don't like doing. What we're actually curious about with sort of, you know, a sudden influx of foreign students is that, you know, they're young, we know they're getting their rocks off. And, yeah, we're really interested in seeing what sort of sexual behaviours people are doing, you know, because our work isn't just about HIV, it's, you know, transmission of STIs as well as sexually transmitted infections. So we're really keen to actually start kind of getting below that layer to see, you know, to start examining or sort of anecdotally hearing what those communities are doing.
Do you get many of the international students coming to you for help?
No, we don't. Look, like the phone line I was telling you about, Connect phone line, we have had a few international students call that. Well, you know, not international students, they're...
Obviously with an accent.
Yeah, but that doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah, they could be living here. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. You know, we work quite closely with places like the Melbourne Sexual Health Centre, which are very close to a lot of the major universities in the city. We work with a fantastic organisation called Multicultural Health and Support Service, who work just with, you know, people from cold communities. And we're actually working together. We're going to be having a forum later on in March to actually look at the issues that stop people from different cultures accessing and seeking information and support, you know, not as easily as, say, it is for many of us sort of, you know, who are Australians. So we're going to be working with them to find out a few more. And, you know, the stuff coming from Melbourne Sexual Health Centre certainly shows a lot of foreign students going there and being tested, you know, being diagnosed with STIs, a couple of cases of HIV infections, but it's not been amalgamated in formal, you know, data and statistics as yet.
That's very interesting, because about 10 years ago I was part of the study about HIV and homosexuality amongst international students. And basically the predominant view was that international students didn't have a sex life, or only gay amongst them.
Was that the study that had that fantastic title of, we're not just all studying, we don't just study, we have sex too, or something like that?
Oh, well, it was a long time ago, yeah. From New South Wales. Yeah. This person came over to South Australia.
And they were quite small figures at the time, but it was showing a pattern, wasn't it?
So, yeah, it was part of this group. But now, what I'm curious about is, do people from different ethnicity deal with their status differently?
Yeah, look, I think when you're talking about sex or sexual health, I can't speak for everyone, but certainly from what we have seen, you know, for example, in India, when you're talking about, you know, a country or a nation that doesn't really talk about sex full stop, you know, you can't get into the nitty-gritty of how you put a condom on and whether you've got crabs or, you know, you've got strange, you know, scratchings or anything down there. There are issues around that, you know, and again, it's different for the heterosexual community, and I'd say, you know, the gay community. You know, if you're from a cold community and you're absorbed into the gay community, there's a certain amount of assertiveness that is within that, you know, and messages around sexual health and looking after yourself are constantly accessible and sort of driven into people. That's notwithstanding sort of issues around sexual racism, where, you know, being somebody who's new to a country or may not be able to negotiate, say, for sex, you're not put upon in a position where you're kind of saying, look, you know, whatever you want, you know, I'm not going to assert, you wearing a condom because I don't know how to.
It's very interesting because I was talking to you about it earlier before the interview about how when I first came here at the age of 20 from Asia, you know, not that I'm saying all Asian men are not assertive, but certainly I was taught to, you know, respect people and be, you know, someone just said, you know, I'm safe, and then I just had to accept that. Coming from that mentality.
Yeah. Yeah, look, and those are real issues. I think there's also something a bit more insidious that goes on there.
Tell us more about that.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, as I was saying, stuff around sexual racism where, you know, people don't necessarily have the courage to negotiate safe sex because they're thinking, well, you know, I'm lucky if I can get sex, really. And, you know, that's really putting it crudely. Mm. But
it's true, you know, and these things happen. But HIV/AIDS isn't just a gay disease, is it?
No, look, globally, it's a very, very different epidemic. You know, when we look at sort of, 33 million sort of HIV diagnosis in the world, you know, 67% of that is in sub-Saharan Africa, where it's actually transmitted through heterosexual sex. It's interesting, we're beginning to see an emerging picture in Australia, certainly in Western Australia, where new HIV infections are actually occurring between heterosexual communities. So, for example, what's happened in Western Australia is a lot of men coming in very, very quickly, being recruited into the resources and mining industries, you know, suddenly getting a lot of money, doing 2 weeks on a rig, 2 weeks off, going off to Thailand for sex tours, or, you know, some parts of Asian countries, or, you know, just suddenly having a lot more liberty to go off and, you know, have an active sexual life and coming back and infecting partners or infecting wives or girlfriends. So we're going to see quite a different picture over the coming years. Or, you know, and having said that, it's still primarily in
about Victoria? What's the mix? Do you see a lot of heterosexual people come through your organisation?
No, not really. No. We have got... there are a couple of great organisations that deal specifically with them. There's Positive Women and Straight Arrows, which are organisations in Victoria that deal specifically with that group. Mm. We absolutely open, because we're the peak HIV and advocacy body in Victoria, we absolutely open our doors and our services to the wider community. But, you know, our client group are mostly gay men.
Mm. So what's the message you would give to the gay community out there about HIV infection?
There
must be a message, you know.
About, you know, the responsibility and care to look after yourself and look after others. It's, you know, none of us should sort of have to compromise our lives or our lifestyles or our choices that we make. But if we do them, whatever course of actions, you know, or lives we choose to live, just think about what we do and, you know, and ensure we have the mechanisms in place to protect ourselves.
And just very quickly, are the younger generation as careful with safe sex?
I will not generalise at all on that.
I think I've read somewhere about it.
I think what's happened, it's for a lot of younger people coming through, you know, sort of sex, having sex for the first time, a lot of them missed the messages, you know, the Grim Reaper and, you know, AIDS being a disease that was going to kill you, and once you got it, that was it. A certain amount of complacency has set in. What's interesting, though, is that increasing HIV infections are still happening in the older population. And while we thought that they were the older population who had got all the messages, they're still becoming infected.
Just one last question. Do you go to the schools and educate?
It's not one area of work I do. As I said, Max Niggle, who coordinates the Speakers Bureau, we do go into schools. It's obviously sort of as part of the sex education curriculum. Not everyone's open to it. Certainly a lot of people are quite welcoming to us, but it's a very effective tool.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, that's On Driven for another week. Our special thanks to Susie from People Living with HIV/AIDS Victoria. Coming up next on Joy is the team from Global Sounds, Paul and Simon. Thanks for joining us on Driven tonight. We'll be back again at the same time, 7 p.m. next Wednesday, with more insights into our GLBT multicultural community here in Australia and around the world. Thanks to Nick on reception for his help tonight.
Yes, thank you, Nick, as usual.
From Kafam and myself and the wonderful Susie, good night.
Good night.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.